from the mind of a 2-foot-tall talking spokes puppet comes this year's biggest challenge. It's time for Bob's Dare to Compare, the hottest game show on TV that asks, what happens when you compare Bob's to the competition? You get style. You get quality. You get beeps and boops and dings and whomps. And thousands of dollars in savings. Everyone's a winner when you dare to compare with Bob's Discount Furniture. Shop in store or at mybobs.com to play now.
We're back with more Hit and Run.
Hey, bada 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 bada, so we bada. Hey, bada 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 bada, so we bada. Kennedy, 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 so we bada.
On 670 The Score.
I think where we are right now, I would say that, you know, moves only for 24. I think unless things change over the next week, I think we probably won't do a lot of moves that only help us, you know, for this year. If moves help us, you know, in 25 and beyond, I think we're still exceptionally well positioned. I think that's what our focus will be. But, like, just helping in 24, I think that probably won't be our focus unless things, you know, change dramatically.
So that's Jed Hoyer with the news of the week in terms of the Cubs. And then yesterday, if you're watching the waiver wire or Twitter or whatever, perhaps you, a Cub fan, if you are one, and a Cub baseball coming up this afternoon, as a matter of fact, right here on The Score. 12:35 pregame, in fact, for the Cubs and the Royals in Kansas City. You would have seen the trade yesterday of the Cubs getting Nate Pearson from the Toronto Blue Jays. Has been like, why are they buying? Are we buyers now? What's going on? This is a trade that is exactly in line with the piece of tape Sean Sears just came out with, because it's not about 2024. It is about 2025 and 2026. This is a big time arm, Nate Pearson. He was probably, what, a top 50 overall prospect a few years back. With a serious, serious arm, a real legit fastball that he still has. There have been injuries. There have been a lot of home runs that he gives up as people are sitting on that fastball and pounding that fastball at times. But he has a very high strikeout rate at almost 30%. He's got a very low walk rate, under 10%. And there might be a way to unlock him. And this is a guy with two more years of control and a big time arm. And there are lots and lots of examples on taking a guy with a real legit fastball and finding a pitch he's not using, or finding teaching him a pitch that you know you're good at, and unlocking a dude. It's incredibly common. And I want to go back and give you some perspective anecdotally from my experience on this, okay? When the Orioles gave up on Jake Arrieta and traded him to the Cubs, oh, God, were they licking their chops, Theo and Jed, as were a lot of teams around baseball. You got to try and find the dumb organization and take big arms they're not using well. And I don't know if Toronto is currently the sucker at the table. I don't know if there's a lot of track record that, but I do know that at the time, the Orioles were 100% the sucker at the table and everybody knew it. What I will never forget is after Arrieta had started to show some promise early on, this is 2015, we did a show with Theo and Jed at, where was it? Not Joe's Stone. Del Frisco's. I don't know if anybody remembers. We did like a series of midday shows with Cubs people at Del Frisco's. And the one with Theo and Jed, off the air, during a break, I said to Theo, hey, so you want to get more from Baltimore? And he looked at me, he's like, yeah, we want to get, yeah, well, I mean, we're always looking for pitching. And I said, how about Kevin Gausman? Do you want that guy? Because I had read that people wanted Gausman. And the look on his face when I brought up Kevin Gossman's name, and he was like, he didn't really say anything. He said, yeah, I don't even remember what he said. I just remember the look on his face. Remember the look on his face. And kind of a wry little smile. Because look at what happened to Kevin Gausman after he left the trash heap of Baltimore. Okay? It was the splitter, right? It's the split finger fastball.
Yeah, split finger fastball. He developed a little bit of a curve as he went along, too, though. But yeah, exactly.
Splitter. But I mean, that dude, he went on to have unbelievable years in San Francisco.
I mean, that whole Baltimore rotation.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
So they were the sucker at the table. Not saying Toronto is necessarily, but if you find an arm like that, they just, you know, you just got to teach him something and make it work. I want to play two pieces of tape, and callers, we're going to get to you. But here's Brian Bannister, a very smart pitching guy who's now with the White Sox, talking about what pitchers need. And actually, first we'll go to Rob Friedman. We'll go to Pitching Ninja on pitchers needing to be different in some possible way.
Well, I mean, it's either the ability to spin the baseball. That's one thing. Some guys are just really good at that. Other guys are really good making the ball go the other way. Some guys have really good command, and that's what they're going to be. Other guys, you can pick up a splitter. You've seen a lot of guys throughout the league pick up splitters. That's taking their arsenal to a whole different level. It may be adding one pitch. It may be adding several pitches. It may be subtracting pitches. The Red Sox have done a great job of subtracting pitches from guys' arsenals that weren't their best, and they felt like they had to throw it just because I have to throw a fastball, but you really don't. So they subtracted some of these pitches out of their arsenals, and that's taken them to the next level. It depends on the organizational philosophy and what you have to work with.
So that's Pitching Ninja, Rob Friedman, on the organizational philosophy, and you can take something, you can add something. Here's Brian Bannister on pitchers needing to be different in some possible way.
I'm a big believer in what I call not ambulance chasing. I don't hunt pitchers down, especially after periods of failure. What I've found over the years is that being patient and being prepared, having the right information to deliver to the pitchers, having the right communication style that's in the format that pitcher likes to learn in, whether it's auditory, whether it's visual, whether it's kinesthetic, whatever their style is. And I study the pitchers, and generally the best time to present to a pitcher is after a period of failure, ironically, because when he's going well, he really doesn't feel like he needs you, or he doesn't want to listen to something new or try something new because he doesn't want to disrupt his current success. And it's generally after he fails, and not just once, but after 2-3 bad outings, they will generally start looking around and trying to find somebody that has the solution to why they're struggling. And it's at that point that if you can be prepared and ready to talk, that's when they're most likely to listen. So
that's Brian Bannister on with Bernsie and Holmes, and that was really good. So look, you gotta pick the right time to talk to a pitcher, and a newly acquired guy is obviously a right time. And then there is the pitch lab, and you're like, boy, they believe they can do that, but they haven't done it real successfully. Well, they have with a few guys. They absolutely have. They did it with Mark Leiter Jr. with the split-fingered fastball. Turned him into an absolute weapon out of nowhere, out of nothing. And maybe they could do it with Nate Pearson. I'll tell you a guy they didn't do it with, who then the Padres did it with, and that's Jeremiah Estrada. I had a chance to ask Carter Hawkins about Jeremiah Estrada, who is the number one setup guy for the Padres and just been absolutely great. And Carter admitted that they missed on this one. What Jeremiah Estrada, the former Cub, is doing in San Diego right now. I think he struck out 13 in a row. He was here and people knew about the four-seam fastball. But why did this kind of breakout not happen for Jeremiah when he was here?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and something that, you know, we are constantly thinking about. You know, how do we have guys that have success when they come over here, and how do we make sure that we're not sending guys away, that there's some lever we could have pulled where they could have success, you know? So Jeremiah is a prime example of that. That's, you know, gnawing on us. They added a split over there. We had talked about it. We had gone through some of it with him, but did not fully pull the trigger and fully commit to it, and had to make some really hard decisions this offseason on who we were going to remove from our roster, and made the decision to go with Jeremiah. And obviously he's shown that that was the wrong decision. So yeah, we didn't pull a pitching lever that we should have pulled, and it's a lesson learned and a hard lesson learned.
So when that happens, do you examine processes? Do you examine tech? Or was it, you know, how do you learn from it when that stuff goes on?
Yeah, I mean, it's the process piece. You know, it's, hey, we identified that, you know, he could throw a split. We identified that that might be something that would help his repertoire. You know, obviously his fastball is pretty special, and we had really focused on that. And we kept our focus on that throughout the season last year. And didn't really put our training economy towards the split. And I think that would have opened up, obviously, would have opened up a lot more performance. And, you know, we had to make a decision to remove them. You know, obviously we didn't want to remove them. We just only have a limited amount of roster spots, and we made some decisions on guys over him. So, yeah, it's if you examine all of that, then you know, the tech is fine. The tech just is what it is. It's just saying what's happening. Now what we actually do with that information is what actually helps us make good decisions, and we just got to be better at that.
Man, that is revealing actual genuine stuff. The tech is the tech. We just got to make better decisions. They missed on Jeremiah Estrada. I bring him up because Nate Pearson's fastball is similar to Jeremiah Estrada's. He's got a four-seamer that has a lot of good carry, the absence of drop. This is a fastball that you can work with. It's got to be paired with something. How many times has Nate Pearson thrown the split-fingered fastball this year? He's got a split. He's thrown it occasionally through the years. How many times has he thrown it this year? The answer is one. One time. So he's got one, but he's thrown it once all year? Folks, look for them to try and figure out how to teach him that split that's better, that he can get more confident with, or lean on him to throw it more. I mean, look, it's working for Shota as well. A vertical drop pitch with a fastball that comes out of the same tunnel is still the best and easiest way to be effective. By the way, Jeremiah Estrada, fifth in baseball in strikeout rate. 13.85 K per nine. He's behind Mason Miller, Aroldis Chapman, Josh Hader, Fernando Cruz in Cincinnati, and Jeremiah Estrada. That's it. Those are the guys up there. Mark Leiter, by the way, ninth on this list.
Hey,
K's per nine as a reliever. So good trade. Good worthwhile trade. They gave up some lower depth in the farm system. By the way, Padres just traded three prospects for Jason Adam from Tampa Bay, including their number one prospect. So that's a lot to give up for a relief pitcher. That's a ton to give up. So
it's a big changeup guy, Jason Adam.
So maybe they really thought they needed that profile in there, but now they've got it. All right, to the phone lines we go. We're going to be here steady right through 12:35. It's another 20 minutes or so of hit and run, including that offensive conversation I told you was coming. I promised it's coming. John is in Minnesota, though, first up on hit and run. What's up, John? How are you?
Spigs, appreciate you. All the years of listening to hit and run, that's the first time I've heard thoughts from a beekeeper. So I appreciate that. Hey, the Cubs offense and fixing it, you know, I think is obviously the biggest question. I think you answered the question, though. To me, they've got to get a superstar into this lineup. And, and to have somebody carry them, I think when you look at them this year, I mean, Hap went through a three-week period, probably the best baseball they played all year. He carried them. I think last year in the second half of the season, Bellinger really was that guy. He hasn't been that guy all year. And I think there's a way to do it. And I think it starts in the next couple of days here. You know, you need to get some salary cap money for next year. And I would try to get rid of Bellinger for a bag of balls to make sure he doesn't opt in next year. I would trade Tyon. I think he could get you back some prospects that you could use down the road to trade. And they have a ton of money coming off the books with, you know, Hendricks is making $16 million. You've got Neris. I mean, for crying out loud, Drew Smyly's making $11 million this year, plus all those guys, the Gomeses, and they're still playing Mancini and Barnhart. It's almost $100 million if Tom won't let Jed go over the cap. It's time to spend stupidly. They have spent, you know, intelligently for 4 or 5 years. They've got a farm system. Go find a superstar and then, you know, maybe use a few of those prospects to help the catching situation. But I think that's the answer. I'm hoping Jed, with only a year left on that contract, will maybe do that and set them up for next year, because it's been painful watching them this year.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it. Yeah, you know, there is a lot of money coming off the books. Bellinger for a bag of balls is an interesting thought. If Bellinger gets traded, people might be incredibly, underwhelmed by what comes back. And the Cubs might have to eat some of that money. Might have to, make some kind of agreement to eat some of that money. Like they would cover, I don't even know how that would work. Because there's no team buyout. It's just the player option at 27.5 for next year and 25 for the year after that. And he might have a decent year somewhere else next year, but you have to take that risk. Hendricks, a free agent, as you mentioned. Drew Smyly has 10 mil in a mutual option for next year. Hector Neris has a club option for 9 mil, but it kicks in if he pitches in 60 games, and it sure is looking like he's going to reach that without a problem. So, but maybe that's okay, because if Hector Neris is not your closer, he's probably a fine arm to have in your bullpen next year at a fairly reasonable rate at 9 mil, just not a closer, as we now know. But yeah, they've got to find a way to get a superstar. I definitely agree. This is Mark in Chicago on 670 The Score. Hello, Mark.
Hey, how are you, Biggs?
Delightful.
Hey, I got a question for you. I've said I'm a self-proclaimed idiot as far as anything other than the culinary world. I'm a chef by trade, but I love the game of baseball, and I played it, and I understand, for the most part, how it works. But my question to you is, I have a theory on your lineup. If you were to take a leadoff hitter, the leadoff hitter's job is to get on base, whether it be a walk, be hit by pitch, or a base hit. Why not think out of the box here, and every position that you have in the field, first base, second base, pitcher, catcher, no matter who, there's always a leadoff hitter in every position. Why not put your roster with all leadoff hitters, because their job is to get on base? My theory behind this is if everybody gets on base, everybody scores, you're going to win games.
Look at you going, you know, that's interesting. You know, when is a team going to respond to the trends by just putting a bunch of scrappy dudes, a bunch of Luis Arraez types, a bunch of Stephen Kwan types out there and let them all scratch their way on? Because even the ones who do that are only successful at getting on 4 times out of 10. The math doesn't really work, unfortunately.
David Eckstein.
Yeah, right, exactly. Guys like that.
David Eckstein.
There's just not enough. There's not enough guys like that, and there are some, but even then, baseball is such a game of failure, and the margins are so narrow that you need other realms of the game to influence the philosophy. You need other rule changes to influence the philosophy. You might need some financial incentives to influence the philosophy. It's almost time to give you my big and stupid idea, which I think is a good idea, but it's also kind of stupid. I don't know. It's interesting. I want to give it to you. But let me take Tony real quick, because he's been hanging for a little while. Then we'll get back to this stuff. Tony, you're in Lombard, and now you're on Hit and Run. Thanks for waiting. How are you?
Good. Thanks, Biggs. Yeah, I appreciate your baseball enthusiasm, as always. Try to tune in as much as I can.
Thanks, dude.
Just a quick thought. I mean, I know it's you think with Seiya, with all those misjudged balls, it could be something they're overlooking with his, with his eyesight. Just to throw that out there. Hmm. Probably not, but it's, But my main thing is, I really think the Cubs are a lot closer than we give them credit. I think they should be buyers. I mean, Hoyer started the season firing Ross because he missed the playoffs, and they hired counsel to get us in the playoffs. And now he's saying this team isn't good enough. He put all his money into Azalea as being a closer. In my opinion, he was never a closer. I don't care how good he did last year. And that's our main thing. I mean, I think we should go after a closer. Don't give up the bank, but get somebody that's decent. If you remember the last series that we played with the Cardinals, why are the Cardinals in first place? Did you see that guy? Like 30-something saves he's got. The Cardinals, if you look at their run differential, I think it's still in a big minus, but they're saving all those games. So now back to the Cubs. We got, correct me if I'm wrong, at least somewhere around 20 blown saves. So I'm thinking if the Cubs win 10 of those games, now we're in, we're in first place. So that's one thing I'd go after, closer. Then, obviously, we need a catcher. We need a hitting catcher. Can we just find somebody that, that can hit, like 250? That will do wonders. And, like you guys are talking about, we got to find a slugger who hits for, you know, who hits for average, hopefully, like, you know, whatever, 270 or over. But, I mean, I think that, I mean, we're really, you know, that close. And we're talking all these one-run games that we lost.
Yeah, Tony. And a lot of the skill sets have, like, you know, the issues have coalesced around the same time. I don't think they're that crazy far away. So it's a matter of, like, trying to build it correctly. This is, I think Jed built an 85-win team that has underperformed. And I think if he'd built a 95-win team and underperformed, they're still going to be in playoff contention here and maybe would have added and stuff like that. But I think he got a little cute and it came back to bite them in the course of this year. All right, look, this is A.J. Pierzynski on with Parkins and Spiegel this week when asked how to get more offense into the game. Here's A.J.
Make strikeouts mean something to the hitters? I mean, that's it. Strikeouts don't matter because the analytics people say they don't matter. And they're actually, you know, if you talk to some analytics people, they'll say like, oh, if you strike out, it actually helps you more than hitting into a ground ball or, you know, flying out. They're like, oh, well, you know, strikeout, well, at least you got, you know, pitch count up and you fouled off a couple and you, instead of like, you know, hitting a line drive, your first or second pitch, you know, you struck out, at least it took three pitches. So it's more valuable. If you want offense to go up, make strikeouts matter again. And that way it puts emphasis on putting the ball in play, puts emphasis on, you know, hitting and running, bunting, things like that. And the offense will go up because there'll be more guys on base, more guys focused on contact. Right now it's like everyone goes up there, even little guys are like, oh, if I hit 20 homers, I'm going to get paid. But you get paid on your power and you get paid on walking and power. So if you take strike three right down the middle, you know, it's 3-2 count. They're like, oh, well, at least you got six pitches instead of, you know, if I put in play, something good might happen. Hey, maybe the infielder boots it or you know, it goes to a hole and then we have a guy on base. And you got to make strikeouts matter, and I don't know they ever will again.
Good stuff from AJ. I don't know how they do that, but I think it's time to start thinking about it in some possible way. How okay are teams with strikeouts? Very, very okay. To the point that some guys aren't even taught that B-hack, that contact swing. Here's our conversation with Nico Horner from earlier in the week on Parkins and Spiegel about offense, and eventually we get to Christopher Morel and this concept.
Rossi emphasized some two-strike stuff specifically at times in a way more so than I feel is often emphasized in baseball now. I think hitting with two strikes is incredibly important, but I do think that the game state is a big factor within that. Obviously, you know, runners in scoring position, runner on third, less than two outs, situations that really reward contact. You know, those are situations where I do think there should be some conscious adjustment. But there's guys that like trying to hit the ball to right field and thinking like seeing the ball deeper is going to make them swing and miss even more because their swing plane can't make contact deep in the zone, so they have to play the game out front. And so it's not as simple as that. But yeah, I mean, I do think, I'm always going to believe in a two-strike approach.
Well, but you have some bat control to do it. It's like, it's so hard, and that tracks that would be important to Rossi because it was important to Theo. You know, like they would hope for that. But not everybody can do it. So this is a really interesting topic.
Yeah, I mean, it's like if there's a runner in second and no outs and your skill set as a hitter is driving the ball to the left side of the field, trying to hit the ball to right field isn't really helping the team because you're likely just going to foul a ball off or swing and miss and then have a two-strike count where no one's productive. So it's even if you're in it wholeheartedly and like trying to do the best thing for the team, that, you know, I'd argue that doesn't help the team very much.
But so what about a guy like Morel?
What about it? Like just his swing in general?
Yeah, his swing in general. I mean, he leads your team in homers. You guys have lacked power this year. He's a raw power guy, but you know, he's with two strikes. He also often is like, yeah, I'm gonna hit. It looks like he's like, I'm gonna hit the ball over the wall, or at least try to.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe
where is he on our team in RBIs?
I think he might be number one. He's certainly number one in home runs. So that's the question.
He's producing runs, and we do it in different ways, even though he hasn't. I think he will hit for a higher average in his career, and I think, you know, that I know people are tired of hearing about things like this, but I think he has had some tough luck this year. But you know, if he's hitting 200 and is near our team lead in RBIs, like the guy
he's
is helping
second.
produce he's helping produce runs, and You know, there might be some situations here or there where, you know, a ground ball to second base would have helped produce a run, but you can't, like, ask for that, but then also, but not credit the three-run homer that he also hits.
That's so, the whole thing.
Is yep, that I think and it goes, and I think the best players are able to do both, and, you know, I would love to hit more three-run homers, and maybe there's some situations where he would love to hit more backside line drives, and we're all looking to improve, but, yeah.
Sometimes we judge these guys assuming that they're being asked to do both, and they're not being asked to do both yeah. sometimes.
I mean, I think the best teams don't have a team approach. I think they have a team full of hitters that embrace their strengths over and over, and together it's like, wow, this team has an incredible approach. But it's a bunch of guys convicted on what they do best, and, you know, some lineups fit together and just gel, and I think we can still do that.
Some great, great stuff from Nico Hoerner there, in my opinion. Some lineups gel, and you've got a collection of good individual approaches, and hopefully they are diverse. The diversification of a lineup is important. So look, I've been kicking this around for a while, a couple of weeks here. How do you improve the game, whether it's, you know, making the strike zone smaller and regulating it is one thing that I believe in. There's been theories out there about making the foul lines wider. You guys ready for this? I've been holding on to this all show. Sean, listen up. Robbie's here. You listen up. Listeners, you listen up.
We are fully engaged.
This is from Mike in LaGrange Park. He had sent this to me, and I think it's an interesting idea. My simple but dramatically effective undetectable tweak: simply move the first base bag exactly 1 foot closer to home plate, 89 feet. Second and third base do not move from their current spot. But this will lead to is more hits. Infielders always play as deep as they can to field grounders, but not so deep that the runner will beat it out. This will force infielders to move in a little bit, thereby having more balls get through. And think of all the bang-bang plays at first base. 95% of the time, those are by design. The fielder is always positioned as deep as they can. Oh, my God, they got a guy by an eyelash. You are going to change the timing of all of those bang-bang plays that we know. There's going to be some frustrated fielders talking about, that's always an out. Now all of a sudden it's not an out. Screw it. Screw it. Only first base is 89 feet. The infielders will have no choice but to move a little closer to home plate in order to nail the runner at first. That will mean more balls get through for hits, hard grounders, medium grounders, and more liners will be just out of the reach of left-right, of fielders. And more of those Texas leaguers, those little duck snorts that are out of the reach of the backpedaling infielders, they will be hits more often. What do you think? Sean? Robbie? Open to it? Hate it?
I don't know how many bang-bang plays there's going to be. That's the only thing.
There's a lot of bang-bang plays.
It would definitely change things. Things would change.
I'm going to talk about this more during the week. Get some of Danny Parkin's thoughts on it. By the way, Mullion Hall will be live from Bears training camp at Hallis Hall from 5:30 to 10 on Tuesday. They'll also be hitting the road and broadcasting live from the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton this Thursday and Friday from 5:30 to 10 with exclusive interviews with special guests, and they'll be reacting to the Hall of Fame game. It's all presented by ChevyDriveChicago.com and the number one draft pick, Chevy Silverado, the official truck partner of the Chicago Bears. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to our guests, Dave Sims on the show, Jim DeShays on the show. Thank you so much to the listeners. Great day of phone calls and texts. Thank you to Sean Sears for all his excellent work. I'll be back with you tomorrow on Parker and the Spiegel. Thanks for listening to Hit and Run on 670 The Score.
From the mind of a 2-foot-tall talking spokes puppet comes this year's biggest challenge. It's time for Bob's Dare to Compare, the hottest game show on TV that asks, what happens when you compare Bob's to the competition? You get style. You get quality. You get beeps and boops and dings and whomps. And thousands of dollars in savings. Everyone's a winner when you dare to compare with Bob's Discount Furniture. Shop in-store or at mybobs.com to play now.
We're back with more Hit and Run.
Hey, bada 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 bada, so we bada. Hey, bada bada. Kennedy.
On 670 The Score.
I think where we are right now, I would say that, you know, moves only for 24. I think unless things change over the next week, I think we probably won't do a lot of moves that only help us, you know, for this year. If moves help us, you know, in 25 and beyond, I think we're still exceptionally well positioned. I think that's what our focus will be. But like just helping in 24, I think that probably won't be our focus unless things, you know, change dramatically.
So that's Jed Hoyer with the news of the week in terms of the Cubs. And then yesterday, if you're watching the waiver wire or Twitter or whatever, perhaps you, a Cub fan, if you are one, and a Cub baseball coming up this afternoon, as a matter of fact, right here on The Score. 12:35 pregame, in fact, for the Cubs and the Royals in Kansas City. You would have seen the trade yesterday of the Cubs getting Nate Pearson from the Toronto Blue Jays. Have been like, why are they buying? Are we buyers now? What's going on? This is a trade that is exactly in line with the piece of tape Sean Sears just came out with, because it's not about 2024. It is about 2025 and 2026. This is a big time arm, Nate Pearson. He was probably what, a top 50 overall prospect a few years back. With a serious, serious arm, a real legit fastball that he still has. There have been injuries. There have been a lot of home runs that he gives up as people are sitting on that fastball and pounding that fastball at times. But he has a very high strikeout rate at almost 30%. He's got a very low walk rate, under 10%. And there might be a way to unlock him. And this is a guy with two more years of control and a big time arm. And there are lots and lots of examples on taking a guy with a real legit fastball and finding a pitch he's not using, or finding teaching him a pitch that you know you're good at, and unlocking a dude. It's incredibly common. And I want to go back and give you some perspective anecdotally from my experience on this. Okay, when the Orioles gave up on Jake Arrieta and traded him to the Cubs, oh God, were they licking their chops, Theo and Jed, as were a lot of teams around baseball. You got to try and find the dumb organization and take big arms they're not using well. And I don't know if Toronto is currently the sucker at the table. I don't know if there's a lot of track record that, but I do know that at the time, the Orioles were 100% the sucker at the table and everybody knew it. What I will never forget is after Arrieta had started to show some promise early on, this is 2015, we did a show with Theo and Jed at, where was it? Not Joe's Stone, Del Frisco's. I don't know if anybody remembers. We did like a series of midday shows with Cubs people at Del Frisco's. And the one with Theo and Jed, off the air, during a break, I said to Theo, hey, so you want to get more from Baltimore? And he looked at me, he's like, yeah, we want to get, yeah, well, I mean, we're always looking for pitching. And I said, how about Kevin Gausman? You want that guy? Because I had read that people wanted Gausman. And the look on his face when I brought up Kevin Gossman's name, and he was like, he didn't really say anything. He said, yeah, I don't even remember what he said. I just remember the look on his face. And kind of a wry little smile. Because look at what happened to Kevin Gausman after he left the trash heap of Baltimore. Okay? It was the splitter, right? It's the split-finger fastball.
Yeah, split-finger fastball. He developed a little bit of a curve as he went along, too, though. But yeah, exactly.
Splitter! But, I mean, that dude, he went on to have unbelievable years in San Francisco.
That whole Baltimore rotation.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
So they were the sucker at the table. Not saying Toronto is necessarily, but if you find an arm like that, they just, you know, you just got to teach them something and make it work. I want to play two pieces of tape, and callers, we're going to get to you. But here's Brian Bannister, a very smart pitching guy who's now with the White Sox, talking about what pitchers need. And actually, first we'll go to Rob Friedman. We'll go to Pitching Ninja on pitchers needing to be different in some possible way.
Well, I mean, it's either the ability to spin the baseball. That's one thing. Some guys are just really good at that. Other guys are really good making the ball go the other way. Some guys have really good command, and that's what they're going to be. Other guys, you can pick up a splitter. You've seen a lot of guys throughout the league pick up splitters. That's taking their arsenal to a whole different level. It may be adding one pitch. It may be adding several pitches. It may be subtracting pitches. The Red Sox have done a great job of subtracting pitches from guys' arsenals that weren't their best, and they felt like they had to throw it just because I have to throw a fastball, but you really don't. So they subtracted some of these pitches out of their arsenals, and that's taken them to the next level. It depends on the organizational philosophy and what you have to work with.
So that's Pitching Ninja, Rob Friedman, on the organizational philosophy, and you can take something, you can add something. Here's Brian Bannister on pitchers needing to be different in some possible way.
I'm a big believer in what I call not ambulance chasing. I don't hunt pitchers down, especially after periods of failure. What I've found over the years is that being patient and being prepared, having the right information to deliver to the pitchers, having the right communication style that's in the format that that pitcher likes to learn in, whether it's auditory, whether it's visual, whether it's kinesthetic, whatever their style is. And I study the pitchers. And generally, the best time to present to a pitcher is after a period of failure, ironically, because when he's going well, he really doesn't feel like he needs you, or he doesn't want to listen to something new or try something new because he doesn't want to disrupt his current success. And it's generally after he fails, and not just once, but after two, three bad outings, they will generally start looking around and trying to find somebody that has the solution to why they're struggling. And it's at that point that if you can be prepared and ready to talk, that's when they're most likely to listen. So
that's Brian Bannister on with Bernsey and Holmes, and that was really good. So, look, you gotta. Pick the right time to talk to a pitcher, and a newly acquired guy is obviously a right time. And then there is the pitch lab, and you're like, boy, they believe they can do that, but they haven't done it real successfully. Well, they have with a few guys. They absolutely have. They did it with Mark Leiter Jr. with the split-fingered fastball. Turned him into an absolute weapon out of nowhere, out of nothing. And maybe they could do it with Nate Pearson. I'll tell you a guy they didn't do it with, who then the Padres did it with, and that's Jeremiah Estrada. I had a chance to ask Carter Hawkins about Jeremiah Estrada, who is the number one setup guy for the Padres and just been absolutely great. And Carter admitted that they missed on this one. What Jeremiah Estrada, the former Cub, is doing in San Diego right now, I think he struck out 13 in a row. He was here and people knew about the four-seam fastball, but why did this kind of breakout not happen for Jeremiah when he was here?
Yeah, it's a really good question and something that, you know, we are constantly thinking about. You know, how do we have guys that have success when they come over here, and how do we make sure that we're not sending guys away, that there's some lever we could have pulled where they could have success, you know? So Jeremiah is a prime example of that that's, you know, gnawing on us. They added a split over there. We had talked about it. We had gone through some of it with him, but did not fully pull the trigger and fully commit to it, and had to make some really hard decisions this offseason on who we were going to move from our roster, and made the decision to go with Jeremiah. And obviously he's shown that that was the wrong decision. So yeah, we didn't pull a pitching lever that we should have pulled, and it's a lesson learned, and a hard lesson learned.
So when that happens, do you examine processes? Do you examine tech? Or was it, you know, what? How do you learn from it when that stuff goes on?
Yeah, I mean, it's the process piece. You know, it's, hey, we identified that, you know, he could throw a split. We identified that that might be something that would help his repertoire. You know, obviously his fastball is pretty special, and we had really focused on that. And we kept our focus on that throughout the season last year, and, you know, didn't really put our training economy towards the split. And I think that would have opened up, obviously, would have opened up a lot more performance. And, you know, we had to make a decision to remove him. You know, obviously didn't want to remove him. We just only have a limited amount of roster spots, and we made some decisions on guys over him. So, yeah, it's if you examine all of that, then, you know, the tech is fine. The tech just is what it is. It's just saying what's happening. Now what we actually do with that information is what actually helps us make good decisions, and we've got to be better at that.
Man, that is revealing actual, genuine stuff. The tech is the tech. We just got to make better decisions. They missed on Jeremiah Estrada. I bring him up because Nate Pearson's fastball is similar to Jeremiah Estrada's. He's got a four-seamer that has a lot of good carry, the absence of drop. This is a fastball that you can work with. It's got to be paired with something. How many times has Nate Pearson thrown the split-fingered fastball this year? He's got a split. He's thrown it occasionally through the years. How many times has he thrown it this year? The answer is one. One time. So he's got one, but he's thrown it once all year? Folks, look for them to try and figure out how to teach him that split that's better, that he can get more confident with, or lean on him to throw it more. I mean, look, it's working for Shota as well. A vertical drop pitch with a fastball that comes out of the same tunnel is still the best and easiest way to be effective. By the way, Jeremiah Estrada, fifth in baseball in strikeout rate. 13.85 K per nine. He's behind Mason Miller, Aroldis Chapman, Josh Hader, Fernando Cruz in Cincinnati, and Jeremiah Estrada. That's it. Those are the guys up there. Mark Leiter, by the way, ninth on this list.
Hey,
K's per nine as a reliever. So good trade. Good worthwhile trade. They gave up some lower depth in the farm system. By the way, Padres just traded three prospects for Jason Adam from Tampa Bay, including their number one prospect. So that's a lot to give up for a relief pitcher. That's a ton to give up. So
it's a big changeup guy, Jason Adam.
So maybe they really thought they needed that profile in there, but now they've got it. All right, to the phone lines we go. We're going to be here steady right through 12:35. It's another 20 minutes or so of hit and run, including that offensive conversation I told you was coming. I promised it's coming. John is in Minnesota, though, first up on hit and run. What's up, John? How are you?
Spigs, appreciate you. All the years of listening to hit and run, that's the first time I've heard thoughts from a beekeeper. So I appreciate that. Hey, the Cubs offense and fixing it, you know, I think is obviously the biggest question. I think you answered the question, though. To me, they've got to get a superstar into this lineup. And to have somebody carry them, I think when you look at them this year, I mean, Hap went through a three-week period, probably the best baseball they played all year. He carried them. I think last year in the second half of the season, Bellinger really was that guy. He hasn't been that guy all year. And I think there's a way to do it. And I think it starts in the next couple of days here. You know, you need to get some salary cap money for next year. And I would try to get rid of Bellinger for a bag of balls to make sure he doesn't opt in next year. I would trade Taillon. I think he could get you back some prospects that you could use down the road to trade. And they have a ton of money coming off the books with, you know, Hendricks is making $16 million. You've got Neris. I mean, for crying out loud, Drew Smyly's making $11 million this year, plus all those guys, the Gomeses, and they're still playing Mancini and Barnhart. It's almost $100 million if Tom won't let Jed go over the cap. It's time to spend stupidly. They have spent, you know, intelligently for 4 or 5 years. They've got a farm system. Go find a superstar and then, you know, maybe use a few of those prospects to help the catching situation. But I think that's the answer. I'm hoping Jed, with only a year left on that contract, will maybe do that. And set them up for next year because it's been painful watching them this year.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it. Yeah, you know, there is a lot of money coming off the books. Bellinger for a bag of balls is an interesting thought. Like, if Bellinger gets traded, people might be incredibly, underwhelmed by what comes back. And the Cubs might have to eat some of that money. Might have to eat, you know, like make some kind of agreement to eat some of that money. Like they would cover, I don't even know how that would work because there's no team buyout. It's just the player option at 27.5 for next year and 25 for the year after that. And you might have a decent year somewhere else next year, but you have to take that risk. Hendricks, a free agent, as you mentioned. Drew Smyly has $10 million in a mutual option for next year. Hector Neris has a club option for $9 million, but it kicks in if he pitches in 60 games, and it sure is looking like he's going to reach that without a problem. So, but maybe that's okay, because if Hector Neris is not your closer, he's probably a fine arm to have in your bullpen next year at a fairly reasonable rate at $9 million, just not a closer, as we now know. But yeah, they've got to find a way to get a superstar. I definitely agree. This is Mark in Chicago on 670 The Score. Hello, Mark.
Hey, how are you, Biggs?
Delightful.
Hey, I got a question for you. I've said I'm a self-proclaimed idiot as far as anything other than the culinary world. I'm a chef by trade, but I love the game of baseball, and I played it, and I understand, for the most part, how it works. But my question to you is, I have a theory on your lineup. If you were to take a leadoff hitter, the leadoff hitter's job is to get on base, whether it be a walk, be hit by pitch, or a base hit. Why not think out of the box here, and every position that you have in the field, first base, second base, pitcher, catcher, no matter who, there's always a leadoff hitter in every position. Why not put your roster with all leadoff hitters, because their job is to get on base? My theory behind this is if everybody gets on base, everybody scores, you're going to win games.
See, look at you going, you know, that's interesting. You know, when is a team going to respond to the trends by just putting a bunch of scrappy dudes, a bunch of Luis Arraez types, a bunch of Stephen Kwan types out there and let them all scratch their way on? Because even the ones who do that are only successful at getting on 4 times out of 10. The math doesn't really work. Unfortunately,
David Eckstein.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Guys like that.
David Eckstein.
There's just not enough. There's not enough guys like that. And there are some. But even then, baseball is such a game of failure. And the margins are so narrow that you need other realms of the game to influence the philosophy. You need other rule changes to influence the philosophy. You might need some financial incentives to influence the philosophy. It's almost time to give you my big and stupid idea, which I think is a good idea, but it's also kind of stupid. I don't know. It's interesting. I want to give it to you. But let me take Tony real quick, because he's been hanging for a little while. Then we'll get back to this stuff. Tony, you're in Lombard, and now you're on Hit and Run. Thanks for waiting. How are you?
Good. Thanks, Biggs. Yeah, I appreciate your baseball enthusiasm, as always. Try to tune in as much as I can.
Thanks, dude.
Just a quick thought. I mean, I know it's you think with Sale, with all those misjudged balls, it could be something they're overlooking with his with his eyesight. Just to throw that out there. Mm. Probably not, but it's But my main thing is, I really think the Cubs are a lot closer than we give them credit. You know, I think they should be buyers. I mean, Hoyer started the season firing Ross because he missed the playoffs, and they hire counsel to get us in the playoffs. And now he's saying this team isn't good enough. He put all his money into Azalea as being a closer. In my opinion, he was never a closer. I don't care how good he did last year. And that's our main thing. I mean, I think we should go after a closer. You know, don't give up the bank, but get somebody that's decent. If you remember the last series that we played with the Cardinals, why are the Cardinals in first place? Did you see that guy? Like 30-something saves he's got. The Cardinals, if you look at their run differential, I think it's still in a big minus. But they're saving all those games. So now back to the Cubs. We got, correct me if I'm wrong, at least somewhere around 20 blown saves. So I'm thinking if the Cubs win 10 of those games, now we're in, we're in first place. So that's one thing I'd go after, closer. Then – obviously, we need a catcher. We need a hitting catcher. Can we just find somebody that, that can hit, like 250? That will do wonders. And, like you guys are talking about, we got to find a slugger who hits for, who hits for average, hopefully, 270 or over. But, I think we're really, that close. And we're talking all these one-run games that we lost.
Yeah, Tony. And a lot of the skill sets have, the issues have coalesced around the same time. I don't think they're that crazy far away. So it's a matter of, trying to build it correctly. This is, I think Jed built an 85-win team that has underperformed. And I think if he'd built a 95-win team and underperformed, they're still going to be in playoff contention here and maybe would have added and stuff like that. But I think he got a little cute and it came back to bite them in the course of this year. All right, look, this is A.J. Pierzynski on with Parkins and Spiegel this week when asked how to get more offense into the game. Here's AJ.
Make strikeouts mean something to the hitters. I mean, that's it. Strikeouts don't matter because the analytics people say they don't matter. And they're actually, you know, if you talk to some analytics people, they'll say like, oh, if you strike out, it actually helps you more than hitting into a ground ball or, you know, flying out. They're like, oh, well, you know, strikeout, well, at least you got, you know, pitch count up and you fouled off a couple and you, instead of like, you know, hitting a line drive, your first or second pitch, you know, you struck out, at least it took three pitches. So it's more valuable. If you want offense to go up, make strikeouts matter again. And that way it puts emphasis on putting the ball in play, puts emphasis on, you know, hitting and running, bunting, things like that. And the offense will go up because there'll be more guys on base, more guys focused on contact. Right now it's like everyone goes up there, even little guys, are like, oh, if I hit 20 homers, I'm going to get paid. But you get paid on your power and you get paid on walking and power. So if you take strike three right down the middle, you know, it's 3-2 count. They're like, oh, well, at least you got six pitches instead of, you know, if I put it in play, something good might happen. Hey, maybe the infielder boots it or you know, it goes to a hole and then we have a guy on base. And you got to make strikeouts matter, and I don't know if they ever will again.
Good stuff from AJ. I don't know how they do that, but I think it's time to start thinking about it in some possible way. How okay are teams with strikeouts? Very, very okay. To the point that some guys aren't even taught that B-hack, that contact swing. Here's our conversation with Nico Horner from earlier in the week on Parkins and Spiegel about offense, and eventually we get to Christopher Morel and this concept.
Rossi emphasized some two-strike stuff specifically at times in a way more so than I feel is often emphasized in baseball now. I think hitting with two strikes is incredibly important, but I do think that the game state is a big, big factor within that. Obviously, you know, runners in scoring position, runner on third, less than two outs, situations that really reward contact. You know, those are situations where I do think there should be some conscious adjustment. But there's guys that like trying to hit the ball to right field and thinking like seeing the ball deeper is going to make them swing and miss even more because their swing plane can't make contact deep in the zone, so they have to play the game out front. And so it's not as simple as that. But yeah, I mean, I do think, I'm always going to believe in a two-strike approach.
Well, but you have some bat control to do it. It's mm-hmm. like, it's so hard. And that tracks that would be important to Rossi because it was important to Theo, you know, like they would hope for that. But not everybody can do it. So this is a really interesting topic.
Yeah, I mean, it's like if there's a runner in second and no outs, yeah. And your skill set as a hitter is driving the ball to the left side of the field, trying to hit the ball to right field isn't really helping the team because you're likely just going to foul a ball off or swing and miss and then have a two-strike count where no one's productive. So it's even if you're in it wholeheartedly and like trying to do the best thing for the team, that, you know, I'd argue that doesn't help the team very much.
But so what about a guy like Morel?
What about it? Like just his swing in general?
Yeah, his swing in general. I mean, he leads your team in homers. You guys mm-hmm. have lacked power this year. He's a raw power guy, but you know, he's with two strikes. He also often is like, yeah, I'm gonna hit. It looks like he's like, I'm gonna hit the ball over the wall, or at least try to.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe
where is he on our team in RBIs?
I think he might be number one. He's certainly number one in home runs. So that's the question.
He's producing runs, and we do it in different ways, even though he hasn't. I think he will hit for a higher average in his career, and I think, you know, that I know people are tired of hearing about things like this, but I think he has had some tough luck this year. But you know, if he's hitting 200 and is near our team lead in RBIs, like the guy is helping produce he's helping produce runs, and you know, there might be some situations here or there where you know, a ground ball to second base would have helped produce a run, but you can't like ask for that, but not credit the 3-run homer that he also hits.
That's so, the whole thing.
And I think the best players are able to do both. And, you know, I would love to hit more 3-run homers. And maybe there's some situations where he would love to hit more backside line drives and we're all looking to improve. But,
sometimes we judge these guys assuming that they're being asked to do both and they're not being asked to do both sometimes.
I mean, I think the best teams don't have a team approach. I think they have a team full of hitters that embrace their strengths over and over, and together it's like, wow, this team has an incredible approach. But it's a bunch of guys convicted on what they do best, and you know, some lineups fit together and just gel, and I think we can still do that.
Some great stuff from Nico Horner there, in my opinion. Some lineups gel, and you've got a collection of good individual approaches, and hopefully they are diverse. The diversification of a lineup is important. So look, I've been kicking this around for a while, a couple of weeks here. How do you improve the game, whether it's making the strike zone smaller and regulating it is one thing that I believe in. There's been theories out there about making the foul lines wider. You guys ready for this? I've been holding on to this all show. Sean, listen up. Robbie's here. You listen up. Listeners, you listen up.
We are fully engaged.
This is from Mike in LaGrange Park. He had sent this to me, and I think it's an interesting idea. My simple but dramatically effective undetectable tweak: simply move the first base bag exactly 1 foot closer to home plate, 89 feet. Second and third base do not move from their current spot. What this will lead to is more hits. Infielders always play as deep as they can to field grounders, but not so deep that the runner will beat it out. This will force infielders to move in a little bit, thereby having more balls get through. And think of all the bang-bang plays at first base. 95% of the time, those are by design. The fielder is always positioned as deep as they can. Oh, my God, they got a guy by an eyelash. You are going to change the timing of all of those bang-bang plays that we know. There's going to be some frustrated fielders talking about, that's always an out. Now all of a sudden it's not an out. Screw it. Screw it. Only first base is 89 feet. The infielders will have no choice but to move a little closer to home plate in order to nail the runner at first. That will mean more balls get through for hits, hard grounders, medium grounders, and more liners will be just out of the reach of left-right, the reach of fielders. And more of those Texas leaguers, those little duck snorts that are out of the reach of the backpedaling infielders, they will be hits more often. What do you think? Sean? Robbie? Open to it? Hate it?
I don't know how many bang-bang plays there's going to be. That's the only thing.
There's a lot of bang-bang plays.
It would definitely change things. Things would change.
I'm going to talk about this more during the week. Get some of Danny Parkin's thoughts on it. By the way, Mullion Hall will be live from Bears training camp at Hallis Hall from 5:30 to 10 on Tuesday. They'll also be hitting the road and broadcasting live from the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton this Thursday and Friday from 5:30 to 10 with exclusive interviews with special guests, and they'll be reacting to the Hall of Fame game. It's all presented by ChevyDriveChicago.com and the number one draft pick, Chevy Silverado, the official truck partner of the Chicago Bears. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to our guests, Dave Sims on the show, Jim DeShays on the show. Thank you so much to the listeners. Great day of phone calls and texts. Thank you to Sean Sears for all his excellent work. I'll be back with you tomorrow on Parkin and the Spiegel. Thanks for listening to Hit and Run on 670 The Score.
We're back with more Hit and Run.
Hey, bada 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 bada, so we bada. Hey, bada 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 bada, so we bada. Kennedy, 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 so we bada.
On 670 The Score.
I think where we are right now, I would say that, you know, moves only for 24. I think unless things change over the next week, I think we probably won't do a lot of moves that only help us, you know, for this year. If moves help us, you know, in 25 and beyond, I think we're still exceptionally well positioned. I think that's what our focus will be. But like just helping in 24, I think that probably won't be our focus unless things, you know, change dramatically.
So that's Jed Hoyer with the news of the week in terms of the Cubs. And then yesterday, if you're watching the waiver wire or Twitter or whatever, perhaps you, a Cub fan, if you are one, and a Cub baseball coming up this afternoon, as a matter of fact, right here on The Score. 12:35 pregame, in fact, for the Cubs and the Royals in Kansas City. You would have seen the trade yesterday of the Cubs getting Nate Pearson from the Toronto Blue Jays. Has been like, why are they buying? Are we buyers now? What's going on? This is a trade that is exactly in line with the piece of tape Sean Sears just came out with, because it's not about 2024. It is about 2025 and 2026. This is a big time arm, Nate Pearson. He was probably, what, a top 50 overall prospect a few years back, with a serious, serious arm, a real legit fastball that he still has. There have been injuries. There have been a lot of home runs that he gives up as people are sitting on that fastball and pounding that fastball at times. But he has a very high strikeout rate at almost 30%. He's got a very low walk rate, under 10%. And there might be a way to unlock him. And this is a guy with two more years of control and a big-time arm, and there are lots and lots of examples on taking a guy with a real legit fastball and finding a pitch he's not using, or finding teaching him a pitch that you know you're good at, and unlocking a dude. It's incredibly common. And I want to go back and give you some perspective anecdotally from my experience on this, okay? When the Orioles gave up on Jake Arrieta and traded him to the Cubs, oh, God, were they licking their chops, Theo and Jed, as were a lot of teams around baseball. You got to try and find the dumb organization and take big arms they're not using well. And I don't know if Toronto is currently the sucker at the table. I don't know if there's a lot of track record that, but I do know that at the time, the Orioles were 100% the sucker at the table and everybody knew it. What I will never forget is after Arrieta had started to show some promise early on, this is 2015, we did a show with Theo and Jed at, where was it? Not Joe's Stone, Del Frisco's. I don't know if anybody remembers. We did like a series of midday shows with Cubs people at Del Frisco's. And the one with Theo and Jed, off the air, during a break, I said to Theo, hey, so you want to get more from Baltimore? And he looked at me, he's like, yeah, we want to get, yeah, well, I mean, we're always looking for pitching. And I said, how about Kevin Gausman? Do you want that guy? Because I had read that people wanted Gausman. And the look on his face when I brought up Kevin Gossman's name, and he was like, he didn't really say anything. He said, yeah, I don't even remember what he said. I just remember the look on his face. Remember the look on his face. And kind of a wry little smile. Because look at what happened to Kevin Gausman after he left the trash heap of Baltimore. Okay? It was the splitter, right? It's the split finger fastball.
Yeah, split finger fastball. He developed a little bit of a curve as he went along, too, though. But yeah, exactly.
Splitter. But I mean, that dude, he went on to have unbelievable years in San Francisco. I mean,
that whole Baltimore rotation.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
So they were the sucker at the table. Not saying Toronto is necessarily, but if you find an arm like that, you just got to teach him something and make it work. I want to play two pieces of tape, and callers, we're going to get to you. But here's Brian Bannister, a very smart pitching guy who's now with the White Sox, talking about what pitchers need. And actually, first we'll go to Rob Friedman. We'll go to Pitching Ninja on pitchers needing to be different in some possible way.
Well, I mean, it's either the ability to spin the baseball. That's one thing. Some guys are just really good at that. Other guys are really good making the ball go the other way. Some guys have really good command, and that's what they're going to be. Other guys, you can pick up a splitter. You've seen a lot of guys throughout the league pick up splitters. That's taking their arsenal to a whole different level. It may be adding one pitch. It may be adding several pitches. It may be subtracting pitches. The Red Sox have done a great job of subtracting pitches from guys' arsenals that weren't their best, and they felt like they had to throw it just because I have to throw a fastball, but you really don't. So they subtracted some of these pitches out of their arsenals, and that's taken them to the next level. It depends on the organizational philosophy and what you have to work with.
So that's Pitching Ninja, Rob Friedman, on the organizational philosophy, and you can take something, you can add something. Here's Brian Bannister on pitchers needing to be different in some possible way.
I'm a big believer in what I call not ambulance chasing. I don't hunt pitchers down, especially after periods of failure. What I've found over the years is that being patient and being prepared, having the right information to deliver to the pitchers, having the right communication style that's in the format that pitcher likes to learn in, whether it's auditory, whether it's visual, whether it's kinesthetic, whatever their style is. And I study the pitchers, And generally, the best time to present to a pitcher is after a period of failure, ironically, because when he's going well, he really doesn't feel like he needs you, or he doesn't want to listen to something new or try something new because he doesn't want to disrupt his current success. And it's generally after he fails, and not just once, but after two, three bad outings, they will generally start looking around and trying to find somebody that has the solution to why they're struggling. And it's at that point that if you can be prepared and ready to talk, that's when they're most likely to listen. So
that's Brian Bannister on with Bernsie and Holmes, and that was really good. So look, you gotta pick the right time to talk to a pitcher, and a newly acquired guy is obviously a right time. And then there is the pitch lab, and you're like, boy, they believe they can do that, but they haven't done it real successfully. Well, they have with a few guys. They absolutely have. They did it with Mark Leiter Jr. with the split-fingered fastball. Turned him into an absolute weapon out of nowhere, out of nothing. And maybe they could do it with Nate Pearson. I'll tell you a guy they didn't do it with, who then the Padres did it with, and that's Jeremiah Estrada. I had a chance to ask Carter Hawkins about Jeremiah Estrada, who is the number one setup guy for the Padres and just been absolutely great. And Carter admitted that they missed on this one. What Jeremiah Estrada, the former Cub, is doing in San Diego right now. I think he struck out 13 in a row. He was here and people knew about the four-seam fastball. But why did this kind of breakout not happen for Jeremiah when he was here?
Yeah, it's a really good question and something that we are constantly thinking about. How do we have guys that have success when they come over here, and how do we make sure that we're not sending guys away, that there's some lever we could have pulled where they could have success, So Jeremiah is a prime example of that. That's, gnawing on us. They added a split over there. We had talked about it. We had gone through some of it with him, but did not fully pull the trigger and fully commit to it, and had to make some really hard decisions this offseason on who we were going to remove from our roster, and made the decision to go with Jeremiah. And obviously he's shown that that was the wrong decision. So yeah, we didn't pull a pitching lever that we should have pulled, and it's a lesson learned and a hard lesson learned.
So when that happens, do you examine processes? Do you examine tech? Or was it, how do you learn from it when that stuff goes on?
Yeah, I mean, it's the process piece. It's, hey, we identified that, he could throw a split. We identified that that might be something that would help his repertoire. Obviously his fastball is pretty special, and we had really focused on that. And we kept our focus on that throughout the season last year, and didn't really put our training economy towards the split. And I think that would have opened up, obviously, would have opened up a lot more performance. And, we had to make a decision to remove them. Obviously, we didn't want to remove them. We just only have a limited amount of roster spots, and we made some decisions on guys over him. So, yeah, it's examining all of that. I mean, the tech is fine. The tech just is what it is. It's just saying what's happening. Now, what we actually do with that information is what actually helps us make good decisions, and we've got to be better at that.
Man, that is revealing actual, genuine stuff. The tech is the tech. We just got to make better decisions. They missed on Jeremiah Estrada. I bring him up because Nate Pearson's fastball is similar to Jeremiah Estrada's. He's got a four-seamer that has a lot of good carry, the absence of drop. This is a fastball that you can work with. It's got to be paired with something. How many times has Nate Pearson thrown the split-fingered fastball this year? He's got a split. He's thrown it occasionally through the years. How many times has he thrown it this year? The answer is one. One time. So he's got one, but he's thrown it once all year? Folks, look for them to try and figure out how to teach him that split that's better, that he can get more confident with, or lean on him to throw it more. I mean, look, it's working for Shota as well. A vertical drop pitch with a fastball that comes out of the same tunnel is still the best and easiest way to be effective. By the way, Jeremiah Estrada, fifth in baseball in strikeout rate, 13.85 K per nine. He's behind Mason Miller, Aroldis Chapman, Josh Hader, Fernando Cruz in Cincinnati, and Jeremiah Estrada. That's it. Those are the guys up there. Mark Leiter, by the way, ninth on this list.
Hey,
Ks per nine as a reliever. So good trade. good worthwhile trade. They gave up some lower depth in the farm system. By the way, Padres just traded three prospects for Jason Adam from Tampa Bay, including their number one prospect. So that's a lot to give up for a relief pitcher. That's a ton to give up. So
it's a big changeup guy, Jason Adam.
So maybe they really thought they needed that profile in there, but now they've got it. All right, to the phone lines we go. We're going to be here steady right through 12:35. It's another 20 minutes or so of hit and run, including that offensive conversation I told you was coming. I promised it's coming. John is in Minnesota, though, first up on hit and run. What's up, John? How are you?
Spigs, appreciate you. All the years of listening to Hit and Run, that's the first time I've heard thoughts from a beekeeper. So I appreciate that. Hey, the Cubs offense and fixing it, you know, I think is obviously the biggest question. I think you answered the question, though. To me, they've got to get a superstar into this lineup. And, and to have somebody carry them, I think when you look at them this year, I mean, Hap went through a three-week period, probably the best baseball they played all year. He carried them. I think last year in the second half of the season, Bellinger really was that guy. He hasn't been that guy all year. And I think there's a way to do it. And I think it starts in the next couple of days here. You know, you need to get some salary cap money for next year. And I would try to get rid of Bellinger for a bag of balls to make sure he doesn't opt in next year. I would trade Tyon. I think he could get you back some prospects that you could use down the road to trade. And they have a ton of money coming off the books with, you know, Hendricks is making $16 million. You've got Neris. I mean, for crying out loud, Drew Smyly's making $11 million this year, plus all those guys, the Gomeses, and they're still playing Mancini and Barnhart. It's almost $100 million if Tom won't let Jed go over the cap. It's time to spend stupidly. They have spent, you know, intelligently for 4 or 5 years. They've got a farm system. Go find a superstar and then, you know, maybe use a few of those prospects to help the catching situation. But I think that's the answer. I'm hoping Jed, with only a year left on that contract, will maybe do that and set them up for next year, because it's been painful watching them this year.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it. Yeah, you know, there is a lot of money coming off the books. Bellinger for a bag of balls is an interesting thought. If Bellinger gets traded, people might be incredibly, underwhelmed by what comes back. And the Cubs might have to eat some of that money. Might have to, make some kind of agreement to eat some of that money. Like they would cover, I don't even know how that would work. Because there's no team buyout. It's just the player option at 27.5 for next year and 25 for the year after that. And you might have a decent year somewhere else next year, but you have to take that risk. Hendricks, a free agent, as you mentioned. Drew Smyly has $10 million in a mutual option for next year. Hector Neris has a club option for $9 million, but it kicks in if he pitches in 60 games, and it sure is looking like he's going to reach that without a problem. So, but maybe that's okay, because if Hector Neris is not your closer, he's probably a fine arm to have in your bullpen next year at a fairly reasonable rate at $9 million, just not a closer, as we now know. But yeah, they've got to find a way to get a superstar. I definitely agree. This is Mark in Chicago on 670 The Score. Hello, Mark.
Hey, how are you, Biggs?
Delightful.
Hey, I got a question for you. I've said I'm a self-proclaimed idiot as far as anything other than the culinary world. I'm a chef by trade, but I love the game of baseball, and I played it, and I understand, for the most part, how it works. But my question to you is, I have a theory on your lineup. If you were to take a leadoff hitter, the leadoff hitter's job is to get on base, whether it be a walk, be hit by pitch, or a base hit. Why not think out of the box here, and every position that you have in the field, first base, second base, pitcher, catcher, no matter who, there's always a leadoff hitter in every position. Why not put your roster with all leadoff hitters, because their job is to get on base? My theory behind this is if everybody gets on base, everybody scores, you're going to win games.
Look at you going, that's interesting. When is a team going to respond to the trends by just putting a bunch of scrappy dudes a bunch of Luis Arraez types, a bunch of Stephen Kwan types out there and let them all scratch their way on. Because even the ones who do that are only successful at getting on 4 times out of 10. The math doesn't really work, unfortunately.
David Eckstein.
Yeah, right, exactly. Guys like that.
David Eckstein.
There's just not enough. There's not enough guys like that. And there are some, but even then, baseball is such a game of failure, and the margins are so narrow that you need other realms of the game to influence the philosophy. You need other rule changes to influence the philosophy. You might need some financial incentives to influence the philosophy. It's almost time to give you my big and stupid idea, which I think is a good idea, but it's also kind of stupid. I don't know. It's interesting. I want to give it to you. But look, let me take Tony real quick because he's been hanging for a little while. Then we'll get back to this stuff. Tony, you're in Lombard, and now you're on Hit and Run. Thanks for waiting. How are you?
Good. Thanks, Biggs. Yeah, I appreciate your baseball enthusiasm, as always. Try to tune in as much as I can.
Thanks, dude.
Just a quick thought. I mean, I know it's you think with Seiya, with all those misjudged balls, it could be something they're overlooking with his with his eyesight. Just to throw that out there. Hmm. Probably not, but it's But my main thing is, I really think the Cubs are a lot closer than we give them credit. I think they should be buyers. I mean, Hoyer started the season firing Ross because he missed the playoffs, and they hired counsel to get us in the playoffs. And now he's saying this team isn't good enough. He put all his money into Azalea as being a closer. In my opinion, he was never a closer. I don't care how good he did last year. And that's our main thing. I mean, I think we should go after a closer. Don't give up the bank, but get somebody that's decent. If you remember the last series that we played with the Cardinals, why are the Cardinals in first place? Did you see that guy? Like 30-something saves he's got. The Cardinals, if you look at their run differential, I think it's still in a big minus. But they're saving all those games. So now back to the Cubs. We got, correct me if I'm wrong, at least somewhere around 20 blown saves. So I'm thinking if the Cubs win 10 of those games, now we're in, we're in first place. So that's one thing I'd go after, closer. Then obviously we need a catcher. We need a hitting catcher. Can we just find somebody that, that can hit like 250? That will do wonders. And, like you guys are talking about, we got to find a slugger who hits for, who hits for average, hopefully 270 or over. But I mean, we're really, that close, and we're talking all these one run games that we lost.
Yeah, Tony. And a lot of the skill sets have the issues have coalesced around the same time. I don't think they're that crazy far away. So it's a matter of trying to build it correctly. This is, I think Jed built an 85 win team that has underperformed. And I think if he'd built a 95-win team and underperformed, they're still going to be in playoff contention here and maybe would have added and stuff like that. But I think he got a little cute, and it came back to bite them in the course of this year. All right, look, this is A.J. Pierzynski on with Parkins and Spiegel this week when asked how to get more offense into the game. Here's A.J.
Make strikeouts mean something to the hitters?
Hmm.
I mean, that's it. Strikeouts don't matter because the analytics people say they don't matter. And they're actually, if you talk to some analytics people, they'll say if you strike out, it actually helps you more than hitting into a ground ball or, flying out. They're like, strikeout. Well, at least you got, pitch count up and you fouled off a couple and instead of hitting a line drive, your first or second pitch, you struck out, at least it took three pitches. So it's more valuable. If you want offense to go up, make strikeouts matter again. And that way it puts emphasis on putting the ball in play, puts emphasis on, hitting and running, bunting, things like that. And the offense will go up because there'll be more guys on base, more guys focused on contact. Right now it's like everyone goes up there, even little guys, are like, oh, if I hit 20 homers, I'm going to get paid. But you get paid on your power and you get paid on walking and power. So if you take strike three right down the middle, it's 3-2 count. They're like, oh, well, at least you got six pitches instead of, if I put in play, something good might happen. Hey, maybe the infielder boots it or it goes to a hole and then we have a guy on base. And you got to make strikeouts matter, and I don't know they ever will again.
Good stuff from AJ. I don't know how they do that, but I think it's time to start thinking about it in some possible way. How how okay are teams with strikeouts? Very, very okay. To the point that some guys aren't even taught that B-hack, that contact swing. Here's our conversation with Nico Horner from earlier in the week on Parkins and Spiegel about offense, and eventually we get to Christopher Morel and this concept.
Rossi emphasized some two-strike stuff specifically at times, in a way more so than I feel is often emphasized in baseball now. I think hitting with two strikes is incredibly important, but I do think that the game state is a big factor within that. Obviously, you know, runners in scoring position, runner on third, less than two outs, situations that really reward contact. You know, those are situations where I do think there should be some conscious adjustment. But there's guys that, like, trying to hit the ball to right field and thinking, like, seeing the ball deeper is going to make them swing and miss even more because their swing plane can't make contact deep in the zone, so they have to play the game out front. And so it's not as simple as that. But, yeah, I mean, I do think, I'm always going to believe in a two-strike approach.
Well, but you have some bat control to do it. It's like, it's so hard. And that tracks that would be important to Rossi because it was important to Theo. You know, like they would hope for that, but not everybody can do it. So this is a really interesting topic.
Yeah, I mean, it's like if there's a runner in second and no outs, and your skill set as a hitter is driving the ball to the left side of the field, trying to hit the ball to right field isn't really helping the team because you're likely just going to foul a ball off or swing and miss, and then have a two strike count where no one's productive. So it's even if you're in it wholeheartedly and like trying to do the best thing for the team, that, you know, I'd argue that doesn't help the team very much.
But so what about a guy like Morel?
What about it? Like just his swing in general?
Yeah, his swing in general. I mean, he leads your team in homers. You guys have lacked power this year. He's a raw power guy. But, you know, he's with two strikes, he also often is like, yeah, I'm gonna hit. It looks like he's like, I'm going to hit the ball over the wall, or at least try to.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe
where is he on our team in RBIs?
I think he might be number one. He's certainly number one in home runs. So that's the question.
He's producing runs, and we do it in different ways. Even though he hasn't, I think he will hit for a higher average in his career. And I think, you know, that I know people are tired of hearing about things like this, but I think he has had some tough luck this year. But, you know, if he's hitting 200 and is near our team lead in RBIs, like the guy
he's
is helping
second.
Produce.
Yeah.
He's helping produce runs. And, you know, there might be some situations here or there where, you know, a ground ball to second base would have helped produce a run, but you can't like ask for that, but not credit the 3-run homer that he also hits.
That's so, the whole thing.
And I think the best players are able to do both. And, you know, I would love to hit more 3-run homers, and maybe there's some situations where he would love to hit more back sideline drives and we're all looking to improve, but,
sometimes we judge these guys assuming that they're being asked to do both, and they're not being asked to do both sometimes.
I mean, I think the best teams don't have a team approach. I think they have a team full of hitters that embrace their strengths over and over, and together it's like, wow, this team has an incredible approach. But it's a bunch of guys convicted on what they do best, and, you know, some lineups fit together and just gel, and I think we can still do that.
Some great, great stuff from Nico Horner there, in my opinion. Some lineups gel, and you've got a collection of good individual approaches, and hopefully they are diverse. The diversification of a lineup is important. So look, I've been kicking this around for a while, a couple of weeks here. How do you improve the game, whether it's, you know, making the strike zone smaller and regulating it is one thing that I believe in. There's been theories out there about making the foul lines wider. You guys ready for this? I've been holding on to this all show. Sean, listen up. Robbie's here. You listen up. Listeners, you listen up.
We are fully engaged.
This is from Mike in LaGrange Park. He had sent this to me, and I think it's an interesting idea. My simple but dramatically effective undetectable tweak: simply move the first base bag exactly 1 foot closer to home plate, 89 feet. Second and third base do not move from their current spot. But this will lead to is more hits. Infielders always play as deep as they can to field grounders, but not so deep that the runner will beat it out. This will force infielders to move in a little bit, thereby having more balls get through, And think of all the bang-bang plays at first base. 95% of the time, those are by design. The fielder is always positioned as deep as they can. Oh, my God, they got a guy by an eyelash. You are going to change the timing of all of those bang-bang plays that we know. There's going to be some frustrated fielders talking about, that's always an out. Now, all of a sudden, it's not an out. Screw it. Screw it. Only first base is 89 feet. The infielders will have no choice but to move a little closer to home plate in order to nail the runner at first. That will mean more balls get through for hits, hard grounders, medium grounders, and more liners will be just out of the reach of left-right, the reach of fielders. And more of those Texas leaguers, those little duck snorts that are out of the reach of the backpedaling infielders, they will be hits more often. What do you think? Sean? Robbie? Open to it? Hate it?
I don't know how many bang-bang plays there's going to be. That's the only thing.
There's a lot of bang-bang plays.
It would definitely change things. Things would change.
I'm going to talk about this more during the week. Get some of Danny Parkin's thoughts on it. By the way, Mullion Hall will be live from Bears training camp at Hallis Hall from 5:30 to 10 on Tuesday. They'll also be hitting the road and broadcasting live from the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton this Thursday and Friday from 5:30 to 10 with exclusive interviews with special guests, and they'll be reacting to the Hall of Fame game. It's all presented by ChevyDriveChicago.com and the number one draft pick, Chevy Silverado, the official truck partner of the Chicago Bears. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to our guests, Dave Sims on the show, Jim DeShays on the show. Thank you so much to the listeners. Great day of phone calls and texts. Thank you to Sean Sears for all his excellent work. I'll be back with you tomorrow on Parker and the Spiegel. Thanks for listening to Hit and Run on 670 The Score.
From the mind of a 2-foot-tall talking spokes puppet comes this year's biggest challenge. It's time for Bob's Dare to Compare, the hottest game show on TV that asks, what happens when you compare Bob's to the competition? You get style. You get quality. You get beeps and boops and dings and whomps. And thousands of dollars in savings. Everyone's a winner when you dare to compare with Bob's Discount Furniture. Shop in store or at mybobs.com to play now.